chapter 17 is where we find ourselves in our journey through the Bible, verse by verse and chapter by chapter. I love that last song. You know, maybe Pastor Stacy and Jen pulled it out because it had the word space in it. You know, with things going on this week. I don't know if you heard there was an eclipse on Monday. And we're still here. But by the way, there is a wonderful, powerful, no, that was in the song. There's a wonderful article that came out from Answers in Genesis regarding what we can learn from eclipses through a biblical worldview. And it is posted on our Calvary Chapel Facebook page as well as my personal Facebook page. So I encourage you, check it out. It is so, it's concise, maybe a 2-3 minute read, and it is spot on. And one of the coolest things is that it talked about the fact that when we have eclipses, there are things that the astronomers are able to calculate decades, if not more, in advance. And that speaks to the design of our universe and that there's a designer, there's a creator. So wonderful, wonderful article that you should check out. The book of Judges is definitely a contrast between Joshua, isn't it? It's a totally different kind of book where in Joshua you see people conquering the land and they're moving forward by faith. And then in Judges we see this defeated people over and over again because of their rebellion to the Lord. And I think a really important thing that we learn from Judges is that disobedience and rebellion always leads to defeat. Don't let the enemy tell you anything different. Disobedience and rebellion always leads to defeat. And that's the sad state of Israel, where we are right now in the book of Judges. There was no king at that time. The people were doing what was right in their own eyes or their own estimation, and that spells trouble. In God's eyes, the people were doing evil. So we come to chapter 17, and really, we're in the final chapters of the book, the final section of the book, and I am sorry to report, sorry to tell you, that things aren't going to get better. From chapter 17 to chapter 21, what we're actually going to see is an appendix that happened sometime probably before the 40-year rule of the Philistines. We're no longer moving through the book chronologically, but one of the reasons why it was probably before the 40-year rule of the Philistines is that we're going to read about the migration of an entire tribe from southern Israel all the way to northern Israel. That would have been very, very difficult to do during the Philistine occupation, so to speak. And so here's this appendix. We're going to be traveling through chapter 17 and 18 this evening. We see confusion in the home and then in ministry and then confusion in society, specifically with the tribe of Dan. Not Dan, but Dan. Chapter 19, the wickedness of a city, Bethlehem and Gibeah. Chapter 20, the stubbornness of a tribe, speaking of Benjamin. And then chapter 21, the brokenness of the nation Israel. And why would there be such a 5-chapter, depressing, terrible, horrific appendix at the end of Judges? It's almost like one big, fat exclamation point of really how bad things were. So I wouldn't use the word necessarily anecdotal, but it's kind of a zeroing in on some specific situations that were going on. And so chapter 17, we speak about the home life first and how all this, everyone doing what's right in their own eyes impacted the home. Now there was a man from the mountains of Ephraim whose name was Micah. And he said to his mother, "The 1,100 shekels of silver that were taken from you and on which you put a curse, even saying it in my ears, here's the silver with me. I took it." And his mother said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my son." So when he had returned the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, "I had wholly dedicated the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a carved image and a molded image. Now, therefore, I will return it to you." And thus he returned the silver to his mother, And then his mother took 200 shekels of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made it into a carved image and a molded image, and they were in the house of Micah. Now, does that sound a little confusing to you? What is going on here? We'll get to that in a minute. But we know that God has established three institutions necessary for the proper functioning and a God-glorifying functioning of a society. So we have the home, we have human government, and then we have the community of God. With Israel, we have the community of God under the old covenant, and then our new covenant entity that we have is the church. The church is under the new covenant. And the first and foremost of these things is the home, beginning with the marriage, the family, the home. It's really the foundation for society. It's the foundation for society, whether people realize it was something that was instituted by God or not. And you know that God set this up in Genesis, and that's why I believe we see such a satanic attack upon the marriage, upon the family, and upon the home. And so the enemy has been hard at work to chip away at these foundational institutions. David wrote this in Psalm 11:3, "If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do?" You start chipping away at the foundation of any kind of building, and pretty soon that building will fall. Well, their home here, Micah's home, was a place of moral and spiritual confusion. If those first four verses sounded a little confusing to you, that's right. They used spiritual terminology, but they did not have God's standards. They used spiritual words, but they didn't use God's words as a standard. And it's important to understand that no amount of spiritual lingo can make up for lack of truth in your home. No amount of spiritual lingo can make up for the lack of truth in your home. And so here we have this man named Micah. His name means, "Who is like Jehovah?" Wow, what a great name. Well, he certainly wasn't living up to that name, was he? He had stolen 1,100 shekels from his mom, and then she pronounced a curse on the thief, not knowing it was her son. And then Micah, he ends up being convicted, do you think by the Lord or the Holy Spirit? No, he's convicted because he heard about the curse that his mom placed upon the shekels and most likely upon the thief. So he's like, I don't want to be cursed. I got to return these shekels to my mom. It wasn't that he was convicted because he had dishonored the Lord and wasn't honoring his mom. But he fesses up, he admits to the theft, and then his mom, quote unquote, reverses the curse by pronouncing a blessing on her son. And there's no discipline at all. There's no bringing in of God's word of any sense. And then what his mom does is she says, you know what? I had dedicated this to the Lord so that, you know, an idol and some molded images and stuff could be made for you. So she takes the money back from Micah, and then she gives 200 of the shekels to a silversmith to be able to have a molded image and an idol to put into his house. That doesn't sound like either one of them are obeying the commandments of God that we find in Exodus chapter 20. Actually, God forbade making a molded image of any kind of form in Exodus 20. And you see in this account that Micah alone breaks just about every single one of the Ten Commandments. We're going to see this. So he's not worshiping God. He made a molded image. He uses the Lord's name in vain with his false worship. He coveted his mom's silver, thou shalt not covet. And then he stole his mom's silver, thou shalt not steal. And then he no doubt covered it up, lying about it, and then returning it only after he heard about the curse. He didn't honor his mom. He definitely didn't keep the Sabbath holy in all of this. And the only commandments of God left undone would be adultery, murder, and bearing false witness. He could have caught that last one if he said, somebody else did it. It was my brother who stole the money. And so here we have this interesting situation, but in the home. And so we see that it's inside the home, things aren't right. They're not right morally because they're not right spiritually. And so the man Micah, he had a shrine and made an ephod and household idols, and he consecrated one of his sons who became his priest. One verse and he just did all this stuff. It sounds way too easy. It doesn't seem like, and he wrestled with this and he was tempted and he fought that temptation. No, just one verse. He had a shrine in his house and he set up all these idols. He made an ephod and then he consecrated and dedicated one of his sons who became his own private priest. He did this so easily, and it represents the spiritual decline in Israel at that time. He had this shrine. What's a shrine? Well, it was just some kind of place of worship in his house, no doubt, for other people to come over to. We know in multiple places that God was the one to determine the place where he would be worshiped. And at this point in Israel's history, where had God determined that he would be worshiped? Shiloh, that's right. That's where the tabernacle was. That's where the spiritual seat of Israel was at this time because of God's determination. He made an ephod, and we remember what the ephod is. It was a very ornate part of the priestly garments. He had the idols and these images in his home. He appoints his own son to be a priest, not caring about what God had already told Israel in Numbers 3:10, that only Aaron's sons could be priests. And also in that verse, Numbers 3:10, you can look it up for yourself. If an outsider attempted to be a priest, he was to be put to death. And so you'd think that a commandment like that would be something that they would be thinking about at this time. We have a clear picture of self-made religion here, and that's really happening today, isn't it? Where people worship a God made in their own image or according to their own desires or thoughts or whatnot. They worship their own image rather than the God of the Bible, the God of truth. And you think, why would you go to all these lengths to end up with something false when God has given us his word and he's been very, very clear, one, about who he is, and oh, he's glorious, and we find out he's loving and he's merciful and he's so gracious. But then also God communicates very, very clearly how he is to be worshiped, how we are to respond to his grace and his goodness. In all of that, we don't get to make up our own concept of God. We don't get to do that. And we hear that in conversations with people sometimes, don't we? Where we're talking about whatever, you know, political events or world events through the lens of Scripture or whatever. And then someone will say, well, I just can't believe in a God who would. And you're sitting there going, well, you should, because that's how God has revealed himself. Furthermore, God has made it absolutely clear how we are to respond to him and his goodness. And so at this point in human history, Israel was well aware that God had spoken to them as to who he is and how man is to respond to his grace and mercy. But this is a period of Israel's history that was in great spiritual decline, and we're going to see part of that in the next chapter. But you probably don't have a lot of people partaking in the worship of Jehovah, obeying the feasts, going to the tabernacle, seeking out priests in their various priestly cities scattered throughout Israel when they had a question about something. So definitely a time of decline. And everyone was making things up. And they said, this seems right to me. And fine, if you have something that seems right to you, you do you. I'm beginning to not like that phrase because it speaks to us of relativism, doesn't it? It really says, hey, what's right for you is right for you. What's right for me is right for me. Somebody will say, well, good for you. I'm glad that's working for you. But what's right for you is not right for me. That's relativism. The problem with this is that such self-seeking leads to ruin. And people end up in our day doing what's right in their own eyes, and they cast off any kind of moral absolutes. There's a great truism that you've probably heard before, and that's this, that right is always right, even if no one is doing it. Wrong is always wrong, even if everyone is doing it. It's black and white. Verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We're reminded once again of the problem Israel was facing. Four times in the book of Judges, we find there was no king in Israel. And then in two of those four references, this is one of them, we notice that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Proverbs 12:15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. That only rhymes in the English. I don't know if it rhymes in Hebrew or not. But may God help us to keep religious and moral confusion out of our homes. And confusion, listen to this, confusion in the home will lead to confusion in ministry. Maybe not even just formal ministry, but ministries that God entrusts to you. And he's entrusted all of us various ministries. And so that's what we see beginning in verse 7. Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, and he was a Levite and was sojourning there. And the man departed from the city of Bethlehem in Judah to sojourn wherever he could find a place. And then he came to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, as he journeyed. So we find out in chapter 18, verse 30, that this man's name is Jonathan. He was a Levite. He had appointed cities to live in, but he was looking for a better life. He left his calling. He wanted a better opportunity. He didn't seek the Lord. He didn't offer himself to be used by the Lord at this dark time in Israel to help maybe turn the tide or impact the nation. And you might say, well, it's only one man. It's just this one Levite. Well, I would say that God only needs one man or one woman to make an impact upon a nation. And you know, for you and me, we only need to make ourselves available to the Lord for him to use us for such a time as this. If your heart, listen, if your heart is set on moving away from the calling of God, there will always be a boat waiting, as was the case with Jonah. You say, I want to be far from God today. Guess what? There will be a path for you. The enemy will do his best to make it happen. And so Micah said to this wayward priest, this Levite, where do you come from? And so he said to him, I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm on my way to find a place to sojourn. I'm just cruising around. And Micah said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 shekels of silver per year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance. And so the Levite went in. And so instead of serving the Lord, Jonathan became a hireling. He settles for far less than he ever should have, but he settled for a yearly wage, a change of clothes, and room and board. How sad. He would have known that being a priest for hire was wrong. He would have known that he was stepping into idolatry. And for Micah, in Micah's case, he knew he was not right, but then I believe that he really wanted this Levite. He's like, oh, here's this Levite. I can hire him. He will legitimize my paganism. It's sad to me that some pastors and leaders in ministry are in it for the career rather than the calling. True shepherds and servants care for the flock, feed the flock, and protect the flock. And when people are hirelings, they do not have the flock's best interest in mind. So here we have this Levite, verse 11, who is content to dwell with the man, and the young man became like one of his sons to him. Originally, he was like, hey, you could be a father to me, but he ended up being like a son to Micah. And so Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. And then Micah said, now I know that the Lord will be good to me. He's going to bless me, since I have a Levite as priest. Well, being content in your flesh can never be the substitute for the peace of obedience. But for Micah, In Micah's case, everything seemed to be working out just fine. The Levite had a good job. He had bettered his position in life. And it may very well have been better than the temple life in Shiloh because of the spiritual decline in Israel, and perhaps the temple offerings were likely down due to that decline. But Micah, he contracted his own priest and then gained a son. Warren Wiersbe said, "When God's people grow indifferent to spiritual things, one of the first evidences of their apathy is a decline in their giving to the work of the Lord." And when we talk about tithing, just real quickly, it's not important because God is trying to raise funds. It's important because God is trying to raise kids with a proper understanding of money. Okay, that's what God is doing regarding tithing. But if you look at verse 13, this is where we really see things are off, where he says, "Now I know that God is going to bless me because I have a Levi as a priest. I've got my own priest. Look at me." He's justifying his idolatry, is what he's doing. He's breaking God's commands. And so he's doing this, and then the Levite, he secured comfort and ease by compromise. So both Micah and Jonathan are guilty. The Levite should have known better, and Micah, who was sincere, was sincerely wrong. And even if someone is very, very sincere, listen, sincerity without the truth is sincerely wrong. It's wrong. And so chapter 18, "In those days, there was no king in Israel. And in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for itself to dwell in. For until that day, their whole inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not yet fallen to them. So the children of Dan sent 5 men of their family from their territory, men of valor, from Zorah and Eshtol to spy out the land and search it. And they said to them, 'Go search the land.' And so they went to the mountains of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there." So we notice the breakdown in the home, then the breakdown in ministry, and now what we start to see is a societal breakdown. And the tribe of Dan is going to illustrate this. And so even though there was no king in Israel, that's not an excuse. It just is stating a fact, because God was to be their king. God wanted his people to look to him, and then if they had a question, they could go to the elders. If the elders had a question, they could go to the priests that were scattered throughout Israel in these Levitical cities, so that they could see what the scriptures say, and they could hear and go, "Okay, we're going to apply this." Now you look at verse 1, and it says, "The inheritance among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them." Well, it had fallen to them, but they just hadn't fully taken it. It had been given to them, it had been allocated to them, but they didn't want to admit that they hadn't dispossessed the Amorites. In Joshua 19, that's where Dan did possess some of the land, but over time we find out that they couldn't fully root out the Amorites, and they were constrained to the mountains, as we see in Judges chapter 1. Dan was abandoning their God-given place, and what we're going to find out is that they were willing to kill innocent people and steal their land because they couldn't dispossess the Amorites in their allotted land. Now, if you take a look at this map, just for our reference this evening, I know the words are kind of small with all the different cities, but this is where the tribe of Dan was allotted here in southern Israel. And this is Ephraim, hill country right here in central Israel. This is also where Shiloh is, where the tabernacle was placed. And then we see the route of the tribe of Dan. They're going to end up all the way in the north in this area called Lachish, this ancient Canaanite area. So that just gives us an idea of what's going on here. Same, it's interesting. The same area where Micah is, and they just happen to stumble upon Micah's house where this idolatry is going on and where there's this shrine and there's this fake place of worship. It happens to be in the very area where the true tabernacle of God was, where God says, this is where I want you to worship, this is what I want you. So Micah couldn't even use the excuse of distance, like we'll see later on in Israel's history. And so in verse 3, while they were at the house of Micah, they recognized the voice of the young Levite, and they turned aside and said to him, who brought you here, and what are you doing in this place, and what do you have here? And so here we have these Danish spies. So not like Danish pies or pastries, but we have these dainty Danishes. They were dainty spiritually, of course. Of course, we would probably say the Danites, right? But their delectable nature will certainly go away later on in this chapter. Charming and winsome, they are not. But here they hear the voice of the Levite. We don't know if he was praying to an idol or singing some kind of idol worship song or, you know, whatever. They may have known this particular man, Jonathan, or what's interesting is they may have heard his dialect and knew that he was from a southern portion of Israel, like Judah and Bethlehem, where he was actually from. So we don't know exactly if they knew him or if they just recognized where he was from and that his speech betrayed him. And he said to them, thus and so Micah did for me. He's hired me, and I've become his priest. And so there's almost a sense of conviction. You look at the pointed questions that the Danites ask him. Who brought you here? How did you get here? What are you doing here? As if to say, you're not, as a Levite, you're not supposed to be here. What are you doing here? And what do you have here? What do you got going on? And then he just says, oh, you know, thus and so, you know, this and that. He just kind of ducks and dives a little bit. And you know, what does thus and so mean? It means not much really. Micah did thus and so for me. What did Micah really do for him? He didn't do much for Jonathan other than give him the means to be disobedient to his calling. That's what Micah did. He didn't do anything for the Levite spiritually. Oh, he did hire him. He gave him a job. But it was a job in idolatry. What could you, as a Christian, be hired for? What would you say no to? Where are your boundaries? What was Jonathan's boundary? Well, his limit, his level was 10 shekels and a change of clothes. Perhaps the job or the idea of being a private priest contractor, so to speak, maybe that stoked his ego a little bit. Or it may have been that Micah acted towards him in a way that was better than his father treated him. But either way, that's no reason to abandon your calling and disobey the Lord. Was it for human acceptance? Well, that's a powerful force for sure. So Christian, you need to settle the issue of what is your integrity worth? What is your integrity worth? Jonathan was Micah's priest, not the Lord's priest. He had lowered himself. He had stooped so low to be Micah's priest. And so they said to him, please inquire of God that we may know whether the journey we're on, if it'll be where we go, will be prosperous or not. And the priest said to them, go in peace. May the presence of the Lord be with you on your way. You'll have a peaceful journey. You'll prosper. Go in the blessing and power of the Lord, Jonathan basically says to them. But how could God possibly bless the tribe of Dan as they're sending out these spies in order to be disobedient to the Lord and leave the very place that God had called them to live? Well, they can certainly ask a priest, but what kind of priest are they asking? Oh, they're asking a renegade priest. This rogue priest was being paid very, very well. Do you think they could get an honest answer? Do you think they could actually get something where they knew that the priest had heard from the Lord? Hardly. They were maybe even thinking, hey, here's a priest. We can get some counsel on somebody else's dime. David Guzik writes this. He said, "This shows what a spiritually confused time this was in Israel. These Danites on a sinful mission met with a sinful Levite and wanted to know from a righteous God if their mission would be successful. Well, then the sinful Levite sent the sinning men on their way with God's blessing. There was moral confusion and spiritual confusion going on in Israel at this time. He says, go in peace, serve the Lord. You know, it's almost like they said, thanks be to God. You know, and they're on their way. And this guy, Jonathan, okay, he's a priest, in air quotes, but he wasn't the Lord's priest. He wasn't connected and in touch with the Lord. Well, if they wanted true counsel, guess what area that they were in at that time? The area of Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. They could have just gone a few miles over to the tabernacle. They could have inquired from the high priest. We're on a mission. Would you seek the Lord for us? Interesting. Well, verse 7. So the five men departed and went to Laish. And they saw the people who were there, how they dwelt safely in the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure. And there was no rulers in the land who might put them to shame for anything. They were far from the Sidonians, their main area on the coast, and they had no ties with anyone. And then the spies came back to their brethren at Zora and Eshtaol, and their brethren said to them, what's your report? And so they said, arise and let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and indeed it is very good. Would you do nothing? Do not hesitate to go, that you may enter to possess the land. And when you go, you will come to a secure people and a large land, for God has given it into your hands, a place where there is no lack of anything that is on the earth. And so these spies, they found an area that was not occupied by the Israelites. They found a colony of the Sidonians, who were fairly far from their mothership coastal colony, so to speak. But they were peaceful. It was a land of plenty. It was a broad land. They had no mutual aid agreements. There wasn't any kind of dictator or ruler cartel kind of activity going on that would hinder them taking over these people. They said the land is really, really good. And what's interesting too is all the way back in Joshua chapter 13, verse 4, that was an area that God had commanded his people to root out and have them be dispossessed, right? So we don't know the reasons why specifically, but this particular area of Laish is basically on the border, I believe, of Naphtali, and then you just pop over the Jordan, and you'd have East Manasseh, so to speak. And so we don't know if it was like, well, that's your area, or that's your area kind of, you know, argumentation going on back and forth. But needless to say, it should have been Israel territory from the get-go. And 600 men of the family of the Danites went there from Zora and Eshtaol, armed with weapons of war. And then they went up and encamped in Kirjath-Jearim in Judah. Therefore, they call that place Mahana Dan to this day. And there it is, west of Kirjath-Jearim. And they passed from there to the mountains of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah. So the Danite spies bring back a good report. It was a bad report, but it was a good report to the elders of Dan. And then they send 600 men of war back up to Laish to conquer the people. And you think, wait a minute, what's the whole premise for them moving and migrating from the south of their allocation to the north? Remember? They couldn't overcome the Amorites. But on the word of five people, all they do, they take 600 men of war to dispossess the Sidonian group at Laish. Huh. So they're strong enough to take out that city with 600, but not strong enough to overcome the Amorites. Confusing times for sure. Verse 14, then the five men who had gone to spy out the country of Laish answered and said to the brethren, "Do you know that there are in these houses an ephod, household idols, a carved image, and a molded image? Now therefore consider what you should do." Maybe not necessarily full throttle idolatry, but these things were made out of what? Silver and gold, and could possibly be even encrusted or bejeweled with gems and different expensive stones or whatnot, right? Hold that thought. So they turned aside there, and they came to the house of the young Levite man, that is, to the house of Micah, and greeted him. And then the 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were of the children of Dan, stood by the entrance of the gate. And then the five men who had gone to spy out the land went up, and entering there, they took the carved image, the ephod, and the household idols, and the molded image. They took all of it. And the priest stood at the entrance of the gate with the 600 men who were armed with weapons of war. And when these went into Micah's house and took the graven image, the ephod, the household idols, and the molded image, the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be quiet. Put your hand over your mouth and come with us. Be a father and a priest to us. It is better for you to be a priest to the household of... Is it better, excuse me, for you to be a priest to the household of one man, or that you be a priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" And so the priest's heart was glad, and he took the ephod and the household idols and the carved image and took his place among the people. And then they turned and departed and put the little ones, the livestock, and the goods in front of them. Isn't this interesting? So these five spies remembered the idols and the carved images and the ephod at Micah's place, and perhaps they could use the loot for their upcoming war and the founding of a new place for the tribe. And so the 600 men stayed at the gate. The five spies go into this shrine and they start grabbing all this stuff. And Jonathan the priest says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And they said, "Be quiet and be hired. How about a raise? Just think of it, Jonathan. Instead of being a priest for just one man in the mountains of Ephraim, why don't you come with us? You could be a priest for an entire tribe, an entire family in Israel." And listen, because he was a hireling, the tribe of Dan hired him. Because his standards were already low, he was ready to go. So instead of being a son like he was to Micah, he could be a father figure to an entire tribe. He sees this opportunity. Aha! It's time to move up. Jonathan the priest cared nothing for Micah, only for the pay and the status that he might get by being the priest for a whole tribe instead of a mere family at Micah's place. And so these Danites grabbed the idols, these gods, they started to do that, and then Jonathan accepts the contract, and then he starts gathering up everything too. He participates with them, and he says, "Sounds great, let's go. Let me help you clean the shelves off." That's what's going on here. Unbelievable. And so the Danites did all this, broke into Micah's shrine, stole his gods, took his personal chaplain, all with no shots fired. What a good day's work. Or a good day of mayhem, I should say. Verse 22. Where are we here? There we are. When they were a good way from the house of Micah, the men who were in the houses near Micah's house gathered together and overtook the children of Dan. And they called out to the children of Dan. And so they turned around and they said to Micah, "What ails you that you have gathered such a company?" So Micah's neighbors and Micah now are going after Dan and Jonathan to get these idols back, and they have the pride and audacity to say, "Hey, are you okay? Like, what's going on here?" And so he says, "You've taken away my gods, which I made." Big problem there. and the priest, and you've gone away. Now, what more do I have? How can you say to me, what ails you? He's saying, are you kidding me? You've taken my gods that I've made with my own hands, and you've taken my priest. What do you mean, what ails me? Listen, if your gods can be stolen, you've got the wrong gods. There's only one God. If your God can be stolen, you've got the wrong God. If your priest can be bribed, you've placed your confidence and hope in the wrong priest. So Micah explains this. He says, how can you say what ails you? Micah, what's going on? Why are you so intense, bro? Are you kidding me? I'll tell you why I'm so intense. Micah, I think, knows he's being mocked. But when you worship idols and false gods, you're going to be mocked. When you worship idols and false gods, you will be mocked. Micah and his family have already mocked God, and now another idol-worshipping group is mocking him. And what did Micah not realize even at this point? When he's saying, you've stolen my gods that I've made with my own hands. He didn't realize that he was actually better off without these things. I remember early on in the 90s, when I was really getting into the Lord and just figuring things out. I was 18, 19 years old. I had tapes that I would play in my car. Remember those? You put them in and you pop the... It had an actual interesting sound, didn't it? When the tape went in, tape came out, or the tape flipped over. It's kind of iconic. But anyway, so over the years, I had a lot of different tapes of secular music. And what's interesting is, you know, growing up in a musical home, and my mom was a lifestyle organist, she would oftentimes give me, she would often give me tapes that was classical in nature, Beethoven, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and Chopin, all these really great things that had wonderful, wonderful value. But that was all mixed in with all my... let's just say my secular music tapes. And it was, you'd look at all the music I listened to and you would say, what in the world, David? What in the world? I remember one trip I was in Boise, I was visiting my cousins, and I left my window down and I came out after some period of time and all my tapes were stolen. And I was so bummed out. And then I looked closer and literally in my tape rack, all of the classical music remained. And at first I was bummed, but then I realized, you know what? It will probably do me good to not have that other music. And so I recognized that fairly quickly, but Micah didn't realize that he was better off without these things. So he had said before, he believed that the Lord would be good to him because he had a Levite in his house, a hired Levite. But now the Lord was actually being good to him in depriving him by force the idols that were hindering his relationship with the true and living God. You see how much God loves him? Instead of just striking Micah dead, Micah, you're done. You're done. No, he gives him a chance. What more do I have? Asked Micah. What more does he have? Really? Micah, whose name means who is like Jehovah? One would wonder if the irony of that statement struck him at all, where he says, you've taken away the very gods that I've made with my hands and now worship and bow down to. But I don't know if he caught that or not. Psalm 135, there are a number of these passages that are very similar in the Old Testament, in the Psalms, in the book of Isaiah. Psalm 135, 15, the idols of the nations are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes they have but they do not see, they have ears they do not hear, nor is there any breath in their mouths. Those who make them are like them, so is everyone who trusts in them. You worship idols like this, and you're no longer going to be able to have any kind of spiritual content coming out of your mouth. You won't have any spiritual vision. You won't be able to hear or have an ear for spiritual things. The very breath of your soul is going to be taken out. So you make an idol like that, you worship an idol, you're going to become like that which you worship. So it's good that we worship the true and living God. And you look at the life of Jesus, and you look at how pure he was, and how a great representation of God he was, and how honest he was, and how caring he was, and how loving he was, and how giving he was, and so amazing. Guess what? You worship Jesus, you're going to become more and more like Jesus. And would that ever be a problem, of becoming more like Jesus? Do you ever get to be so much where it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa? I mean, the world will say, you're becoming way too much like Jesus, sister. Slow down. The world might say that, but God will never say, you're too much like my son. You know, slow down. No, it's great. And that's our discipleship, isn't it? We're being molded and fashioned and conformed into the image of Jesus. And so each of us will either worship a God of our own making or worship the true and living God who made us. But listen, anytime someone makes an idol, they're always less than even us, because it's always something where you're worshiping this form of yourself. So the foolishness of Micah's elaborate idolatry is really exposed in verse 24, where he says, what more do I have? You've stolen my gods. You've taken my priest. I have nothing. Well, all this stuff didn't give him any kind of lasting blessing in his life. All right, verse 25. And the children of Dan answered and said to him, do not let your voice be heard among us, lest angry men fall upon you, and you lose your life with the lives of your household. And then the children of Dan went their way. And when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. Well, that escalated quickly. Now, either Micah and the neighbors retreat, or they die. That's what the Danites, this amazing tribe of Israel, they're saying. They're acting like thugs, aren't they? They're saying, look, if you don't turn around right now, it would be a shame if something happened to your family, or, you know, say some kind of wiring situation happened in your house and started a fire and your house burned. Boy, that would be horrible. And so Micah weighs this and then quickly turns around, realizing, you know, that he could not come against the tribe of Dan with their 600 armed men of valor. And it's just Micah and his neighbors. What are they going to do? So they turn around. And what's so sad is that a tribe, an Israelite tribe, is doing the exact same thing that the Philistines did to Samson's wife back in chapter 14. You remember that? When they said, you get the riddle out of Samson in one way or another, or we're going to burn you and your father and the household alive. We're going to toast you. We're going to come and kill you. Charles Spurgeon said, if he became a wiser man, he was a great gainer by his loss. If ritualists and others could be cured of their folly by the breaking in pieces of all their altars and the pulling down of every cathedral in the land, it would be a cheap remedy. Oh, that God would visit this land and with his great besom, I don't know what that word means, sweep out the priests and their idols. May he also cleanse the temples of our hearts. For this, let us pray. He's saying, man, he's crying out to the Lord that we would just strike down the idols in these false places of worship. We should never worship a God that needs our protection. Amen? So they took the things, verse 27, Micah had made, and the priest who had belonged to him, and went to Laish, to a people who were quiet and secure, and they struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire. And there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon. and they had no ties with anyone, no mutual aid or defense contracts. And it was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rahab. And so they rebuilt the city and dwelt there. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan, their father, who was born to Israel. However, the name of the city was formerly Laish. And so with their 600 armed men, they come upon the city of Laish, and they ultimately fully take it over and destroy it. No one was left. They kill all of the humans there, burn the city, and then they start rebuilding. Someone has said that there are only three philosophies in life in today's world. Number one, what's mine is mine, I keep it. Number two, what's yours is mine, I take it. And number three, what's mine is yours, I will share it. And so the Danites, they followed the second philosophy, what's yours is mine, I'll take it. And so too do many other people, even in our day. With all of the lawlessness going on, much of it manufactured by lawless leaders, we know that theft is on the rise, isn't it? You know, it used to be here in Northwest Montana that you could leave your car unlocked, you could leave your home unlocked, you know, that kind of thing. Those days are gone. And so the Danites, how did they start out? Well, aside from being far from God, they start out with breaking and entering with their robbery and then intimidation upon Micah and his household. And then now violence and murder. God never directed them to take on Laish and kill everything that moved. This was way out of bounds for them as a tribe. Listen to what Jacob prophesied about the tribe of Dan, Genesis 49:17. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward. Wow, that's not a prophecy of blessing, is it? So Dan is fulfilling this prophecy. We don't know how many people died in Laish, but it was a slaughter for sure. Well, then the children of Dan set up for themselves the carved image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of their captivity of the land. And so they set up for themselves Micah's carved image, which he made all the time that the house of God was in Shiloh. It would seem that things were going well for the tribe of Dan. Jonathan's blessing came true. They had a new home, a new idol. They had their own priest, and even a growing priestly ministry with Jonathan's sons. And notice now that his choices affected his kids. His choices affected his kids because now his sons, plural, are involved in idolatry. And this is the very beginning, my friends, of established idolatry in the Promised Land. Oh, it was going on before, but now it's established in one of the tribes. This is now official idolatry going on. And how did it start? Do you remember how it started all the way back in the beginning of chapter 17? It all started when Micah stole 1,100 shekels from his mom. And it spiraled in to this whole thing where an entire city was murdered, wiped out, and now Dan has an official idol worshiping area in northern Israel. Micah probably had no idea that his sin would end up snowballing like this. A tribe now has set up officially a rival worship center in Israel, going against the true worship center in Shiloh with the tabernacle in Ephraim. Even though there was a real worship center there, Dan became content all the way up to their captivity with worshiping idols there. Well, years later, when Israel became divided between the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2, Dan would go even deeper into idolatry under Jeroboam. He would set up golden calves in Dan and Beersheba in the south, encouraging the entire nation to go after them and turn away from the living God. And if you've been to Israel, one of the places that you end up visiting is this area in northern Israel called Dan. It's called Tel Dan. It's a hill called a tell where they do archaeological excavations and have found all this stuff. They actually found the very altar that they set up for calf worship under Jeroboam. You can go there and you can see the things today. It's remarkable. But you look at this occasion here, and it's likely why it was so easy for them to go national with their idolatry under Jeroboam, because they started out at a tribal level. And then already, though, for them to worship idols at the tribal level, they were worshiping idols at the family level, and they were worshiping idols at the individual level, right? It starts with the heart. Dan ends up not being mentioned in a number of the lists of the tribes of Israel in the Bible. He's listed in some of them, but not all of them. One particular list is found in 1 Chronicles, I believe beginning around chapter 4, but the intriguing one that I would point out is the list of tribes in the book of Revelation where God takes 144,000 Jews and commissions them in the tribulation period like traveling Billy Grahams or traveling Greg Laurie's, right? That preaching the everlasting gospel to the people. Dan's not mentioned. Well, how can you get to 12 tribes? Well, remember when we talk about tribes, there's most often 12, sometimes they're 13, but that happens because of Joseph, because of Manasseh and Ephraim. So sometimes they're compressed into Joseph. Joseph's mentioned, Ephraim and Manasseh are not mentioned, and then the Levites are mentioned. And then when those are open, then the Levites are not mentioned. And then, anyway, so in Revelation, Dan is not mentioned at that time. So it's very interesting there, especially in light of the last days. But for today, people need the truth, don't they? They need the truth, even if they don't want to hear it. They need to know that Jesus Christ died for lost sinners, and that the power of Jesus can transform hearts and homes and churches and societies, but people have to trust them. People have to trust God. They have to trust the Word. That's the bottom line there. We need to know the truth, and then God calls us to communicate that truth. But you know where it starts? It starts with applying the truth to your life, applying the truth to your heart, saying, yes, Lord, and then applying it to the ever-widening spheres of influence that you have in your life. And I'm going to tell you this, probably as a reminder, that all of you have spheres of influence that start with your spouse and your family, your kids, grandkids, family members, jobs, school, friends, neighbors. We all have that type of influence. I want to show you very quickly, we do have time, so I want to show you just a couple of pictures. Do you guys like pictures? It's worth 1,000 words, so we'll be quick.